Everyone, I think we're ready to get started with our second panel today. This is a student perspectives panel, and I'm going to turn it over to our qualified moderator, Judd Campbell, who is the executive director of the Constitutional Law Center here at Stanford Law School. Judd?
Okay, thanks, John. So I'll briefly introduce the panelists. We're going to be invaded by 1Ls at about 12:10 or 12:15, who have a class in here for lunch. So the first up will be Ilan Werman. Ilan's an associate at Winston & Strawn in D.C. He's a 2013 graduate of Stanford Law School. He clerked for Jerry Smith on the Fifth Circuit. And my next bullet point is writes a lot of law review articles. This is kind of an understatement. Ilan has often sent me an article before I've had a chance to read the last one he sent me. And he has one coming out in the Stanford Law Review, which I'm delighted about. Roland Nadler is a fellow at the Stanford Center for Law and the Biosciences, colloquially known as one of Hank's people around here. He's a 2015 graduate of Stanford Law School. He's going to clerk for Brock Hornby in Portland, Maine next year, and his research focuses on law and neuroscience and also on sentencing policy. And last up will be Sohan Dasgupta. He's a 3L at Berkeley Law School. He has a PhD in international law from Cambridge, a master's degree from Oxford, and a BA from Columbia. He's going to be clerking for David Faber on the District Court for the Southern District of West Virginia, and for Connie Callahan on the Ninth Circuit. And he's the author of a book on international dispute resolution. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Ilan.
Thanks, Judge. Judd, so when we were discussing among the panelists what we would be talking about, and we saw Sohan's credentials, we all agreed that he would be going last, so we don't have to follow his act. But I was president of the Stanford Federal Society here, I guess, in 2012 when I was a student, and this is my first time speaking at a Federal Society event, so it's a great honor and privilege to be invited to speak here. But at the same time, I'm not sure that I am worthy of the honor of giving remarks on a topic such as this, intellectual diversity and political correctness. Because I think the questions raised in this conference and on this panel go to something very profound and important. They go to the very foundation of Western civilization, to the root of what it means to be a Western man or woman. Now, I did something there. I elevated, to a certain extent, Western civilization. Now, in a normal college environment, I would have perhaps been kicked off the stage already. But I think Western civilization, its history, and its future is intimately connected to the questions of intellectual diversity and political correctness. Because ultimately, as others wiser than I have suggested before, there has been no civilization in all human history that has been more open to self-criticism and more open to the diversity of ideas than has been Western civilization. Now, I do not wish to be misunderstood on this point. This is not to say that Western civilization is better in all respects, or even in most respects. On the contrary, Western political philosophy requires a questioning of the existing regime. It demands the search for truth. It seeks to discover better regimes, and ultimately, I think, the best practicable regime. And that requires seeking the flaws in the existing one. We might recall from undergrad, or if you took a political theory seminar with Michael McConnell, as I did here at Stanford, that Socrates, the founder of Western political philosophy, undermined the gods of his city and was put to death by it. Western political philosophy, in other words, does not require acquiescence in or obsequiousness to the gods of our time. On the contrary, it demands a thorough examination of the existing regime and the ideas on which it rests. But that is all to say that Western civilization is unequivocally better in at least one respect than those cultures and civilizations that differ from it in this regard. And that is in its openness to self-criticism and the diversity of ideas. Can you imagine having this conference on this topic in modern-day authoritarian China? Can you imagine having this conference in the many Middle Eastern countries that routinely deny their citizens' basic human rights today and the right to free speech? Can you imagine having this conference in Canada? That might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but Canada does have a so-called human rights commission that hauls people before it to answer for speech that they have made, including political speech. So we should all, therefore, take a moment to reflect on this proposition, which I firmly believe to be true, that all philosophical discussion, all the political and legal debates that we're used to having as lawyers and law students, intellectual diversity itself can only exist in a regime that is profoundly respectful of this enterprise of free inquiry. And we all, therefore, should have a profound respect for that regime, which allows us to engage in it. Hence my invocation of Western civilization at the beginning of my remarks. So why do I mention this here to a law school audience? Because it is here, at the law schools, and at the university campuses across the country, and now also among the wider body politic, that this Western culture, this culture that prizes intellectual diversity, that prizes philosophical inquiry into the good and bad of other cultures and into the good and bad of its own culture, this culture has come to be replaced by an altogether different kind of culture, the culture of multiculturalism. This, I think, has been something of a raw deal. Multiculturalism is a kind of variant on Western civilization's openness to other cultures. But it warps that openness from an inquiry into the ideas of a culture, which stem from a combination of things, like the innate characteristics of its people, their environment, their historical experiences, their interactions with other cultures, random variation, human will and ingenuity, into an inquiry into the innate characteristics only. Multiculturalism defines culture. It defines diversity along the characteristics one cannot choose: being black, being gay, being Jewish, and assumes that cultural perspectives are somehow shared as a result predominantly of these innate characteristics. But this multiculturalism seriously degrades the enterprise of free inquiry, I think for at least three reasons. First, if culture is a product of these innate characteristics, how can one be better than another? What does it mean to search for the good and bad in black culture, or the good and bad in Jewish culture, or in gay culture, and so on, if there's nothing we can do with that knowledge, if there's nothing we can change? Secondly, and this obviously follows from the first point, multiculturalism no longer values choice or rational thought. It devalues what makes humans human, the capacity to think about the future, and thus the consequences of their actions, and thus their ability to make choices. Third, multiculturalism is simply wrong as a descriptive matter. Culture is not the sum of its people's innate characteristics. And its people's innate characteristics surely are not the highest expression of a culture. Rather, a culture is, descriptively, a product of much more. Of all the things I previously described, environment, historical experience, interaction with other cultures, random variation, and most importantly, of human will and ingenuity. It is the combination of these traits and these experiences that form the highest expression of culture, that of its ideas, and especially of its important ideas, those about the good life and about its political regime. So too often, I think, we see interest groups or even student associations, like here on campus, form around these innate characteristics. There may be many legitimate reasons for these associations, particularly social reasons, but to the extent their perspectives are valued solely because of the innate characteristics of those who hold them, this is a hollow diversity. Stanford, I'm pleased to report from my time here, I think was quite a Western law school in the sense that I have described. For as bad as some conservatives might think they sometimes have it here, we had it pretty good here. This school, to its credit, and more importantly, to the benefit of its students, still takes seriously, I think, this notion that higher education is ultimately the search for answers to the most important questions, to those about how we ought to live our lives, and to those about how we ought to order our political regime. And to find these answers, we have to ask the right questions, questions that transcend far beyond a person's skin color, ethnicity, or sexual orientation. These are the questions over which people and cultures have profoundly disagreed across time and place. But these disagreements, this intellectual diversity, is, if I may borrow the words of a political philosopher of the last century, the secret to the vitality of Western civilization. And as stewards of the legal regime that continues to support and propel that civilization, it is particularly incumbent upon us here to recognize that that is the kind of diversity worth fighting for. It might even make life worth living. So I'll conclude on this note. I am often asked how I can be both gay and conservative. And I like to say that being gay doesn't define me, at least not that much. Of course, it defines me in the same way that being born male defines me, or being born tall or short might have defined me, or being born Jewish might define me. That's because I didn't choose to be gay. In the same way, I didn't choose to be born Jewish. But being conservative, or I should say, for those who know me, being classically liberal and occasionally Burkean here and there, those are choices that I made as a rational, free-thinking human being. Those choices are acts of the intellect. And it is those acts, it is those choices, which even if wrong, should be celebrated as belonging to that great diversity, which is the secret to the vitality of our civilization.
All right, Roland.
Thanks. So I'm afraid, lacking the rhetorical flair that Ilan has brought to the table, I'm going to endeavor to keep my remarks on the short side, and that's in part because of the role that I have styled for myself on this panel and in discussion with
the gadfly
panelists. Not so much the gadfly as the petting zoo specimen, right? I am here as an avowed campus leftist, free to be poked and prodded and asked questions without me accusing you of oppressing me. You know, to that end, I very much want to thank the organizers, Jonathan and Michael, for asking me to be on this panel. This is not an act of empty tokenism, but rather an admirable putting into action of the principles that animate the conference. And so I'm quite appreciative of that. And when I was asked, I thought, well, what really are my qualifications for sitting on this panel besides yelling on Facebook a lot about campus leftism and political culture issues. And I thought about it a bit, and you know, for instance, when I was trying to decide where I wanted to look for clerkships, I did think, oh gosh, I don't want to be clerking with a judge with whom I'm going to agree all the time. I'd like to clerk for a centrist judge who will change my mind hopefully many times, at least once, and maybe I will attempt to change the judge's mind at least once. I'm also on the record in favor of intellectual diversity in my other discipline, the discipline that I came to law from, which is neuroethics. And sort of on that note, I wanted to quote to you a little bit from a piece that I published with a co-author talking to our sort of disciplinary cohort, in which we said, our field must not remain apolitical. We do not mean that it must take sides in the broader political culture war. Rather, we urge neuroethicists to recognize that the field has its own internal politics. That is, a set of competing visions about what is healthy for the field, whose interests to favor, which ideas are treated as axiomatic, how research agendas are prioritized, and why the field exists. It is crucial that neuroethicists engage in discussion and, yes, disagreement about these competing visions. Failing to do so will not preserve a state of comfortable neutrality. Rather, it will leave neuroethics vulnerable to covert colonization by whichever ideology happens to be most natural, most effective, or worse yet, most profitable. So, as you may infer from sort of how I've presented myself as a panelist, there are many kinds of Republican I am not, but one kind of Republicanism that I very much believe in is civic Republicanism. And that's a theme that I think I want to highlight throughout both my remarks and my answers, which is that I'm really very invested in a kind of civic Republicanism of the vital, rowdy, and often polemical variety. I think that it is important and good and healthy for members of a polity to hash out their political disagreements in open fora in attempts not only to convince each other, but really to actually convince third parties who may be watching. And a lot of what you'll see in sort of the way I think about free speech is that there's a deep challenge when it comes to striking a balance between the airing of passionate moral emotions, which are a key part of free speech, and mitigating the chilling effects that might be caused by overheated discourse. And this is an issue which I think has been quite live in many of the past year's discussions over campus activism. And in particular, so there's a blogger that I follow a lot who covers these issues, and a quote from him that I think is really key here is that assertive, aggressive, hyperbolic speech is not in itself censorship, rather it is a speech act. And it's wrong to claim that it is censorship. Maybe another way of approaching this is to say that we're very invested, of course, in the role of principle in these campus debates. And one of my focuses, again, both in my remarks and in my Q&As, is going to be that we already often let our principles yield to competing concerns in the extreme. And I'm going to be emphasizing this not in a bid to establish some kind of false equivalency between extreme cases and more moderate ones, but to insistently highlight that what we are having is always, always a debate over where to draw the line, over how to reconcile and optimally balance sets of irreducibly competing principles. Sort of to illustrate this, here's a quote that you might expect to hear from the mouth of a dangerous campus activist, which is, "At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument is needed. Oh, had I the ability, I could reach the nation, and I could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake." Now, this quote actually has its origin in one of the more extreme cases. This is Frederick Douglass inveighing against slavery and in favor of abolitionism. And my goal, again, is not to make any suggestion that any of the issues that are currently under debate around campus activism are on any level morally equivalent to chattel slavery. Rather, the point is to emphasize that there are times when it is true that we do need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake, that the ideal of reasoned debate that is dispassionate and calm and aimed at persuading one's interlocutor rather than making a show of the importance of moral emotions to observing third parties in an attempt to sway them to your cause, those are speech acts, those are an important part of free speech, and to the extent that these tactics have been embraced by the campus left, it has been, I think, for those of us participating in that tradition, frustrating to see a characterization of our participation in those speech acts as inimical to, rather than an exercise of, the principles that we all care about. I keep on using the word "we" here. I don't mean to imply any level, any amount of consensus among campus leftists or activists. I think it is a highly internally fractious movement in a way that I guess today many political movements are highly internally fractious, but it's certainly, there's no consensus that I'm attempting to speak from. These are more my experiences. So With that in mind, and with an eye to the conference program's focus on the interaction between issues of political correctness and free speech on campus and their downstream effect on the heart of this conference, which is intellectual diversity in academia, well, I'm going to use the balance of my time to walk through just a couple of the hot-button issues that have come up, especially in the past year, around campus speech and activism. And my goal here is, of course, not in this context to convince you that campus leftists are on the correct side of these issues, but rather that if we are wrong, we are wrong for non-crazy reasons, that what we are doing here is operating from a set of concerns and principles that are actually quite accessible to anybody who gives it a clear look, and that where the disagreement arises is much more in, again, how to reconcile the competing principles. So I'm gonna walk through four and then yield the rest of my time. So those four are trigger warnings, microaggressions, safe spaces, and the big commencement speakers, brouhaha. So of the four issues that I've mentioned, the fight over trigger warnings is the one that, as a hopeful one day law professor, I understand the rancor over the least. I see it as sort of part and parcel of what my job would be as an educator to say, hi, potential students, I'd like to reach out preemptively to you and let you know that you know, I'm here to support you and work with you, and should any of the material that we touch on in this course be personally upsetting or bring up aspects of your experience that make it difficult for you to learn, I am here to facilitate your learning as an educator. It seems to me that this is a curing of information asymmetries. And of course, like, yes, there is a risk that this can induce self-selection out of difficult material. This is a risk that already exists to the extent that syllabi are circulated in advance for any class. And it strikes me as not a huge extension of that risk. And really only if trigger warnings are overdone, and I think the sort of caricatured way that they've been discussed in the media, where instead of as a statement of here's the content of the course and here's my commitment to support you, they are cast as you know, this course contains dangerous and wrong-thinking material. That would be an example of overdoing it. It is not, I think, what most people that I have spoken with who would incorporate these into their syllabi are actually interested in doing. So when it comes to microaggressions, this is one of the few areas where I actually feel enough confidence to bring my sort of law and neuroscience angle into the debate, and sort of highlight the extent to which we can't unring the bell of knowing that small sub-actionable harms of social rejection have a cumulative effect, that when you have a brain pickled in cortisol over a long period of time, you have caused harm. So what I want to encourage is thinking, when people talk about microaggressions, in a sort of class action litigation kind of metaphor, right? That if everybody's harmed for a penny, a harm still exists. Now, I'm very open to having a discussion about what exactly should be done to redress the harm. But I think, again, that we can't unring the bell of waking up to realizing that actually there are aggregate harms that exist like this. And so because I'm short on time, I'll just come to safe spaces and leave it there. So safe spaces are a great example of actually an ideal that we can all get behind existing in tension with another ideal, namely freedom of association. This is a good thing, right? And sometimes it can abut free speech. This is a tension that we are familiar with. It's legitimate to wish for a haven from the upsetting tumult and tempest of political dispute, especially when, as I think many campus leftists do, you feel that what's up for debate is your basic right to inclusion and an equitable stake and status in your community. And we all create, these little havens writ small in our daily lives anyway. Of course, again, they can be overdone. One of the things I will emphasize a lot is that in any situation of movement politics, excesses come with it, and I'm not here to, sit in defense of every single excess that exists. But I would similarly point out that when it comes to movement politics, a set of ground rules that are agreed upon by all participants in particular spaces for organizing has always been crucial to making political progress. It is possible to create tents that are so big that they collapse in on themselves, and that is never how movement politics has made its progress. So those are just several examples of how and about campus leftists might think about some of the issues that are swirling in this conference today. And I look forward to being held to account for the internal consistency of these positions in Q&A. Like I said, I promise I won't bite. I'm here to explain.
All right, thanks, Roland. Sohan?
Thank you. I promise to generally be in line with Ilan and to not oppress Roland.
I don't know if I can experience oppression from you.
You feeling the vibe? Such an honor and a blessing to be here with you all today. Thank you to Stanford Law School, the Federalist Society, National, Michael Jonathan, and my co-panelists, Judd, Ilan, and Roland. The other speakers have been wonderful about empirical data and very cerebral scholarship, so I'll focus more on the personal and experiential dimensions. So there's a bold orientation to what I say, Berkeley Law, but it's not limited to that. And I hope some of these insights are illuminating while others are entertaining, and others still are both. I'm Sohan Dasgupta, currently president of the Berkeley Federalist Society, and my remarks principally concern the costs of intellectual monochromatism that are borne substantially by the dissenters. And that's because the great weight of intellectual thought in law schools among students today is tied to viewpoint-based sifting, even insidious discrimination, and some identity politics. They're all tied together. Ladies and gentlemen, the great tumor of our age is that we often tend to care more about who's doing the speaking rather than what is being said around law schools today. This is in addition to tuning out or denying the right of meaningful speech to disagreeable speakers on campus. In any event, what is alarming today is that today discourse and free speech are often subordinated to some purportedly greater demands of making people feel comfortable. Now, whenever I hear that word comfortable, my first instinct is to paraphrase the very elegant Justice Scalia, who said the Constitution, I think he talked about the Bill of Rights in this respect, isn't meant to make us comfortable, it's meant to make us free. But it isn't even comfort that this will produce. After all, blinders produce a slanted vision, and everybody knows that slanted visions are uncomfortable in the long run. So what it sadly generates is an exclusive monopoly on speaking in the marketplace of ideas, and it's detrimental for the legal culture and for the rule of law. The philosophical isolation is not good for the individual, but it's presently the price of doing business. But it's strikingly famishing for the law school's own diet to have a philosophical imbalance. Even more debilitating for the law school and for the individual, though, is the subtle discrimination now imposed on unconventional thinkers, conservatives, moderates, other dissenters, sort of like Vox Clamantis in Deserto, voices crying out in the wilderness. These second generation barriers to entry are flourishing today against unconventional thinkers. It used to be against liberals in the 20s and 30s, and now it's against conservatives and moderates in law school are different from the 1980s more belligerent version. Now it's subtler, finer, more lethal, less discourse-laden. Somebody's safe space is denial of somebody else's right to speak or even to belong on campus, death by a thousand cuts. Then there are the political witch hunts that follow. The pretext for getting an unconventional thinker, really dissident, will be something entirely different at times. Should you write your admissions essay or have your academic scholarship be about the importance of your Catholic or Protestant faith. Certain faiths are often targeted, not others. Or the freedom of religion in general, or wanting to defend white-collar criminals, your other credentials best be significantly high to compensate for those cardinal deficiencies. Or you had best already been a Supreme Court justice or a Court of Appeals judge, maybe even cured cancer, Nobel, Pulitzer, something like that. You need to balance it. And conservative academics find it disappointingly hard to make it onto law school faculty, so there's an asymmetry there. I think it's greatly to the credit of Justice Scalia's championing of originalism and then Dean Elena Kagan's courage of convictions that three originalists have made it onto the Harvard faculty, but that's rare. Beyond one or two openly conservative faculty members, you won't find too many. And there are many who try to earn a position there. There's a famous story about UCLA's law faculty when one academic who later on became the dean of Chapman was interviewing there. An elderly faculty member leaned over and said that we've already got Volokh, why do we need him? Even though Volokh and this gentleman were not exactly of the same viewpoint on every issue. There are anecdotes galore. And, you know, that applies to students and faculty alike. Several law schools don't consider working for the DA, the U.S. Attorney's Office, prosecution work to be pro bono. You don't get the credit hours for that. You're not eligible for it. But if you happen to work for the public defender, you do get those hours. You do get that credit, which is a pity. Then there is the left's dog whistle politics, the coded thesis underlying inclusiveness and compassion. I love those words, which are encouraging and promising terms heralded by law schools, but too often we disappointingly find that this inclusiveness or this compassion requires an ideological or philosophical litmus test of sorts before the rewards or just plain equity are meted out, before they'll be bestowed. Moreover, cabining off safe spaces means that few with anything short of full-throated and enthusiastic support of the status quo will have a meaningful right to be heard. So that's where we are. So much so that even President Obama, irrespective of what his departments of justice and education may have done in this field with their rulemaking and their dear colleague letters, over which I do not opine, felt compelled to criticize this campus indulgence of insulating students from vigorous debate. Because we all lose when we begin to censor ideas and thus contract the spectrum of ideas which are acceptable even to be heard in the public sphere. Consequently, these factors will effectuate a powerful philosophical imbalance on law faculties and on legal education generally. When the law students go out into the world, they expect the same rules to be observed, and they're not going to be. They'll be in for an unpleasant awakening. Today we hear law schools outdoing each other with enthusiastic excitement over globalism, and rightly want to send their alumni out to lead legal practice across industries from the UAE to Argentina. When the students go there and expect not to be confronted with anything they deem politically incorrect, which inherently is a culturally laden term of art with meanings that vary widely between what to expect in the Bay Area and what's okay in Nashville or Durham, let alone in New Delhi or Doha, those students will find themselves utterly unprepared by their alma mater's ethos having mollycoddled them over the past 3 years, perhaps longer. The echo chamber problem, as Professor Phillips referred to it earlier, is going to hurt moderate and liberal students for those reasons. Now the dissenters. You've got your principled mantle, and that's the key adjective, principled. It's a matter of principle. It's not a matter of preordained results or outcome-oriented expedience. Several themes are important here. Let's continue with the presupposition, cherished in some quarters, that philosophical divergence is correlated with phenotypical and communal identities. What do I mean by that? Race, ethnicity, sex, sexual orientation, religion, etc. And that campuses of all places become fixated on these notions. It's not unduly reductive to maintain that there's a victim in all this, and that victim is the individual who deigns to think for herself, whose sincere reasoning and life experiences refuse to yield to a certain kind of expected groupthink. It's a stereotype, no doubt, but some argue that it's a benign stereotype, one that's used to include rather than exclude more and more people into the we the people fabric of this great nation. I think I read that in a concurrence in Grutter. One might be forgiven for failing to accept the justification for this kind of stereotyping, because for one, when did we get to the point of saying that stereotyping for a good purpose is okay, though stereotyping for a malevolent purpose will not be tolerated? Stereotyping over generalization alone is the fruit of a poisonous tree, if not the tree itself. And stereotyping done one day for a purportedly good reason will fall into the hands of an official mischief maker sometime in the future, who doesn't have such benign or anodyne intentions in mind. It's a loaded gun. Once a close law school friend, a conservative of conscience and of color, was told by a civil rights activist, a fellow student, that, of course we assumed you'd be a liberal. You're a Nigerian guy at Berkeley. It's up to you to clarify that you're not. The burdens have shifted, ladies and gentlemen. This is just the tip of the iceberg with respect to the intra-group dissenters within the ostensibly marginalized communities and the inverted violence and exclusion inflicted on them. There are stories of catcalls, violence that has gone unreported, barely audible mutterings of traitor sellout and the like that occur. I draw upon the experiences of law school conservatives, particularly those who are persons of color and or have LGBTQ sexual identities. There's almost an underlying outrage. How dare you think outside the box that has been crafted for you? How can you do a 180 on our hard-won sacrifices? But it is to honor and cherish those earlier sacrifices whose objective had been to liberate individuals from being typecast as members of groups and to emancipate them with opportunities to be individuals with inherent dignities and thoughts that we all today dare to think for ourselves. There's also an intellectual and cultural hubris that even to saying that the dimensions of the box, that is to say positions on particular issues, are allowed to be predetermined by certain powers that be in today's zeitgeist. And perchance, if there's no other cross on which to nail an independent thinker who goes against the expected grain, through robust insinuation, some charges are often manufactured against which the intra-group disappointing dissenter can't possibly defend themselves in time, but which hang upon the office upon which they're about to enter like the sword of Damocles. And that's often the tune in law schools and well beyond. But we have no reluctance whatsoever in sustaining faith and confidence that principles are worth standing for. And second, it's particularly neglectful of geography, history, and statistics, if nothing else, to assume that the origins with which persons of color are identified don't have conservatives. India right now is dominated by the conservative BJP. Uhuru Kenyatta's National Alliance in Kenya governs that country's parliament, and so on. Since we inherit most of our philosophical beliefs from our families, it's not inconceivable that conservatives and basically non-liberals who are identified as persons of color, particularly immigrants, would have views close to those from their persons of origin, from those of their origins. Hence, it's no great surprise that many conservatives of whatever background would think for themselves and happen to find themselves in law school environments on these shores where they continue to do so. The rule of law and the intellectual stimulation and education of all of us would be greatly improved. I think I'm short on time, so I'm just going to cut to the chase. Please allow me to get a little bit personal and use the device of contrast to do so. One Berkeley race scholar likes to say that many of us, for people, it's easier for the subconscious to imagine himself, as a fire-breathing lion than as a person of a different race or gender. He goes through a dream sequence to get there. So that's the bottom line of this thought experiment. Now contrast this with the lives of many of us. I grew up in large part in Asia. I like my cricket, the Tagore and Borges poems I was taught by my grandmother, the hard sciences I endeavored to do but mostly struggled with, the dogs that my cousins and I had, the guava trees in the backyard. In my dreams, I felt I had a certain wondrous kinship with kids all over the world and in places I had never even visited. A boy in Holland, a girl in China, a girl in Egypt, a boy in Kenya, a girl in Switzerland. I like the Alps. It never even crossed my mind what their races were then or now. And I don't think that only my hyperactive imagination was responsible for this. It's because the qualities that confer upon us attributes that go to the very hearts of our personhood, those are the qualities that make us who we are. And the who will always be more important than the whats, the checklist features of phenotypical and communal attributes. It's no answer to say whatsoever that one is an outlier to believe all this, that the polity doesn't operate from these premises or employing these assumptions. Maybe so, maybe not, but that's not the point. The point is that this is the ideal to which we must aspire, and that ideal frees individuals, including those in a law school setting, to think for themselves, emancipated from the boxes into which they have been relegated. Otherwise, it would be akin to indulging a highly erroneous assumption going into the 21st century. To paraphrase National Review's Peter Lawler, the study of law serves viewpoint diversity by reminding us that what justice, a component of law, though by no means the exclusive one, is a perennial and invincibly difficult question that has a variety of plausible answers. When the study of justice is replaced by slanted conceptions of social justice, in inverted commas, viewpoint diversity always suffers simply because those with different views of the place and significance of justice are marginalized or worse. We should be better than this. We owe it to the rule of law, to our traditions, and to our progeny. Thank you for your kind attention.
Okay, we'll only have about 15 or 20 minutes for discussion and Q&A, so I'll ask for quick responses among the panelists to each other if there's any discussion, and then we'll open it up to the mics.
So I have a short response, and I'll limit it to microaggressing against Roland. But first, I cede 45 seconds of my time to try to learn why disinviting commencement speakers is potentially justifiable, or how liberals think about it.
So what I had prepared on this is that surely you can think of a person that you'd be angry if your institution, without consulting you for input, cut a large honorarium check to and offered you to them as a captive audience on a day that's supposed to be about celebrating you, and then you voice your dissent about it and get branded an enemy of free speech, is the short version. I think that the disinvitation rhetoric has been a little misleading, because often what's actually happening here is not disinvitation, but dissent, and then the dissent gets read immediately as an attempt to disinvite. I think that if students were exercising disinvitation power, I'd get a little more nervous, but this is not what I've seen in this debate.
Okay, so I mean, I don't follow it too closely, so they aren't clamoring the administration to disinvite speakers?
But they are doing so from a position where they don't have power to actually make good on that demand.
Okay. So I'm not entirely sure about that, but I'll ask I'll make my other point, which you mentioned irreducibly competing principles. And I guess what you're saying is that two competing principles here are the thunder and earthquake speech of liberals that want to not hear certain things protest against other speech or potentially shut down other speech. I'm not entirely clear on what it is, but my question is, isn't the solution to these, or how to balance these principles, already in the Constitution of the United States, in the First Amendment, which allows free speech, but has a kind of John Stuart Mill harm principle, right, embodied in it, which, you can't defame someone with your speech, right? You can't incite violence. Once in like the 1930s, someone couldn't have fighting words. I don't know if that's still good law. But that's a harm principle, and I think we can all get on board with that. And it seems that, you are advocating in terms of trigger warnings, or I don't know if advocating, but explaining, trigger warnings, microaggressions, safe spaces, is that people don't want to be harmed. So the principle in abstract actually seems to be the same, but aren't we diluting the content of what it means to be harmed to the point that there's such a low bar that there's no bar at all?
So I think, and this is what I was sort of emphasizing with the unringing the bell metaphor, which is that what we are doing is developing a much more sophisticated ear for what it means to be harmed, what it means to be harmed collectively, what it means to be harmed in small amounts that then aggregate up. And we are shedding, I think, to a great extent, our long insistence on the notion, that physical injury is of some absolutely sui generis category that it needs to be forever disaggregated from mere emotional slights, as though these mere emotional slights don't ultimately register in a physical system that is the brain, which is very much a product of the stress hormones that are triggered within it.
Pushing back a little, but again, I guess I like to find solace in the law, and doesn't the law have responses to this? Like the intentional infliction of emotional distress. When someone wants to discuss the history of the KKK or is reading a book on the KKK, and was he intentionally trying to inflict emotional distress on someone? I don't think so. So I think the law has categories that have evolved over time because they work, and I'm wondering if modern campus liberals are just trying to expand those categories such that they become ultimately meaningless, or in the eye of the beholder, eye of the beholder, maybe.
The meaninglessness I once signed on to, but there's no question that this is an effort to expand those categories in response to a widely shared feeling that the previous line drawing exercise was premised on assumptions that no longer quite fit our understanding of both power dynamics in society and individual experience of real harm, right? There's this absolutely a line redrawing exercise, but that's not to say that the principle that animates the debate is no longer respected. It very much is.
All right, let's take some questions.
Yeah, I had actually two questions for Roland. The first is whether he realizes that his argument about saying that emotional harms correspond to physical harms is supported by a famous law review article by Bork. Who made that argument. But the more serious point, I was interested in the issue of passionate speech, which I've observed mostly in online controversies rather than here. And I can see three different reasons for such speech, only one of which I approve of. One of them is to convey to your listeners your feeling in the hope that that will change their views. One of them is to make yourself feel good and to raise your status with your own in-group by showing that. And that what strikes me in the online controversy is that most of the people engaging in this are in fact subverting their own side. That is to say, they are making their side look worse. Well, this is not necessarily passionate. Some of this is insulting people, all sorts of stuff of that sort. And that pretty clearly tells me that their real incentive is not what they claim it is. Their real incentive is to feel good and to show them. Third reason, and the only one which counts as censorship, is that you're using these emotional means in order to make it costly to be on the other side. So that if lots of people say, well, you said X, you must be a racist. And people don't want to be considered racists, don't want people who have never heard the discussion and don't know the content to think they're racists. And the reason you're doing this is to shut people up. And it seems to me that that third really is censorship, even though it's not legal censorship because you don't have legal power, but that in terms of its intent, it is censorship. And I guess part of the question would be how much of the passionate speech that you're defending is in which of these categories. And I guess one more thing, and that is on the question of the commencement speakers, because I can understand the argument that you don't want to give money to people you disagree with. On the other hand, if you don't want to hear people you disagree with, if you prefer people who are preaching to the converted when you're one of the converted, that, it seems to me, is a fault in you, not in them. And there's a very simple test, and that is when there is a public lecture by somebody on the right or the left, which ones do the students on the right or the left attend? You're attending the public lecture, doesn't give anybody any money. If you prefer to listen to people who will tell you how wonderful your ideas are, then you go to the one who agrees with you. If you prefer to listen to people from whom you might learn arguments against your views, then the one you disagree with. And you can presumably collect casual data looking at things on your campus and figure out which is really going on.
So to sort of speak to the sort of grand forum of the internet, that set of issues. Let me, in sort of answer to the different reasons you've run through, kind of give you my theory of Facebook political disputing, right? It's kind of, the reasons are kind of a hybrid of the ones you've talked about. I'd note that, like, all argumentation, in a sense, is a process of making it costly to hold the opposing view. Now, whether you're making it costly in terms of how a person is viewed in, like, with regard to their moral bona fides versus how a person is viewed in terms of their ability to debate, right? Those are different ways of making it costly for somebody. But at some level, right, when you show that a person is wrong and hoist them by their own petard with some elaborate rhetorical ruse, you are making it costly for them to hold the opposing view. You're doing it for a much better reason when it comes to convincing the other side. But this sort of segues into what I want to emphasize about the kind of civic republicanism I'm talking about, which is that I don't often engage with people that I know are going to disagree with me with the aim of persuading them. The aim, rather, is to convince third parties viewing the dispute that both by dint of, like, a better argument and by the selective recruitment of justified moral emotions, right, that mine is the side of the fence worth tipping onto.
You never consider the possibility of engaging in the debate on the possibility that it might change your views?
Oh, no.
That wasn't in your list of reasons.
The point is rather that my primary concern in this kind of, you know, political forum is first and foremost to say, look, people's politics are extremely entrenched, and probably the best way to generate more light than heat is to, in engaging, show other people whose minds aren't yet made up why the position that I'm taking is actually not only
is correct or is emotionally satisfying. Those aren't quite the same things.
Those two are actually hard to disentangle when you get.
Do you distinguish between getting somebody to not believe something and getting somebody to not say he believes something? Because those are very different goals.
Sometimes it's the former, sometimes it's the latter. That's so situational.
Well, if it's the latter, you should not be doing it.
I will say on the prior point, there's some good authority for Roland's statement. I think it was Ben Shapiro, a young conservative radio personality, that once said, don't argue with a liberal unless one of two conditions is met. You absolutely have to, because your grade depends on it in class, for example, or you've got an audience, because otherwise it's just not worth it. You're wasting your time.
You've got an audience.
You might persuade other people. Okay.
All right, Jim.
Very quickly, I must make slightly tangential point, but the honorarium issue for commencement speakers, notwithstanding the fact that students are clients, as it were, rather than citizens of the university, not wanting to give money to those with whom they disagree, what are the proponents of that? You know, people don't want to do that. Think about public sector employees not wanting to give money to the public sector unions with whom they disagree. Just a curious point to throw out there.
I think those are pretty differentiable cases, but one thing I'll say is that what I think students in the commencement speaker issue really would like is for these decisions to be made with their input. These are decisions that are purportedly for them. They should represent them.
Well, right now at Bolt, we haven't got a single outside commencement speaker because of the union boycott, which asked outside speakers not to accept Berkeley speaking engagements. So right now we haven't got a single person coming to our graduation from the external environment to speak.
All right, Jim?
So I wanted to push back as quickly as I can on, so trigger warnings, I think one should, with my own opinion on this, I think you should avoid gratuitous harm, but we shouldn't think there was something inherently wrong in triggering. And you talked about psychology. It's not a literature I know, but some of my colleagues on the Heterodox Academy have written that in therapy, do they try to avoid the thing that you're fear of, or do you confront it? And they say the absolute consensus in therapy is you confront it. On microaggressions are real, but one of the things that my colleagues in Heterodox Academy say is there's a huge literature on what reduces racism, and a microaggression training is highly unlikely to reduce racism. Putting someone in a room and saying you're doing lots of bad stuff is a terrible way to reduce racism. So even if they're real, I'm not sure this is the way to go. And then think about conservatives. How many conservatives are subject to microaggressions? A lot, which I'm sure you don't disagree with.
Yeah.
And then safe spaces. I think everyone should be able to retreat to their room or whatever and not be hassled. But beyond that, safe spaces are places where you don't hear ideas that you disagree with that bother you. What conservative could hope to be educated in an environment in American universities in which they have that kind of safe space? None of them. So I think that's asking a bit much, and I'm not sure who said that safe spaces are places where cultures go to die. And that's my opinion. And I'm not sure, you may want to comment or not, or you might just want to take another question.
Do we need to move on, or can we hear the last question and then answer one or both? Or?
That'd be fine, yeah.
Well, I guess I'm here to pile on a little bit.
I volunteered myself for this. I'm here
petting
against
specimen, it. You said?
Yeah, petting zoo specimen.
Petting zoo specimen.
You're here to pet some more, right?
Well, I think what I find most troubling about the student movements this last fall is this assumption that education should be inoffensive, right? Because diversity, deep diversity, which involves clashing views of the good, society, is inherently offensive, right? So, right, because then you're debating things like the ethics of abortion, right, or the good society, there's no way that conversation isn't offensive, right? And the alternative education, right, I think, is a fundamentalist one, right, where you go to someplace like Liberty, and you're not, the whole point of that education, it seems to me, is to protect and shelter you from views that might undermine your faith and tradition. And so if we really value diversity, right, it seems to me we really want a very offensive education. But I guess the other thing I would say is that I do think the movement, I guess my other concern is that it's cultivating a culture that's hostile to the free expression of ideas. And I think we see this in some of the climate surveys, right? I mean, I would encourage you all to look at the climate survey that the University of Colorado did, where students are say, look, I'm afraid, I don't speak up in class, I feel intimidated. So free speech is not, you know, it requires a certain kind of culture, and that culture is fragile, because there is something very unnatural about creating an institution that's designed to be offensive, right? It's just, okay.
So when it comes to, the hostility point, one thing that I want to try to underscore is that I feel there's been this huge boogeyman mythology created of how terrible it is to be viewed as the person who said the wrong thing. One of the things that's discussed a lot in these left activist and organizing circles is, God, like, if you just do it right, it's so easy to meaningfully apologize, right? To make amends if you actually sort of like take responsibility for the thing you did that hurt people, right? This is something that has been, I think, extensively discussed in these circles, is like the more we ramp up the extent to which we are going to be sensitive to how speech can harm, the more we are going to get really clear on, like, here's how you redress, like, that harm as a person who is accused to have committed it. So at the end of the day, right, like, even like if I go around within like you know campus like activist and organizing circles, and I eventually say something that is you know wrong think right like the A that's inevitable, and B the consequences aren't all that terrible if I say oh like my bad for violating the you know the shared convention of this space, like I'll do better next time. So I want to sort of deflate the extent to which that's. So here's what I think is the really interesting question, is how do we mutually optimize amongst the principles of charity and the constant situation that politics unfolds amidst a trust gap, right? Because I think where people are coming from with this culture of uncharity is, gosh, we've been through it a million times where somebody says something that we know is actually a dog whistle for a policy that hurts us, and then they retreat into the, oh, no, I didn't mean it that way, be more charitable. So I think what you were witnessing is a sense of exhaustion with the demands of that and an attempt to redraw where the intersection of those two principles falls, right?
They're both good principles. Time for one more question.
So instead of piling on, I wanted to say something in defense, at least in the safe spaces argument. If I hear Roland correctly, he's saying, you know, I didn't hear him defending the idea that you know broad swaths of the campus ought to be made safe, but rather that it ought to be permissible for groups to form who are like-minded to have a safe space. And having defended that proposition in the United States Supreme Court a couple of years ago, unsuccessfully, I'm still with Roland and against the Supreme Court decision. The particular group that wanted a safe space was the Christian Legal Society at Hastings Law School in San Francisco, which among other things. One of the religious beliefs is they didn't believe in same-sex marriage, and the university, public university, would not allow them to have a group just of themselves. They insisted on a so-called all-comers policy, which is to say a no-safe space a policy. And I would just say, if we're going to have safe spaces, and I think we should, I think freedom of, I agree with Roland that freedom of association does sometimes allow self-selected groups to retreat and be just among themselves. But it ought to be for everybody. Yeah. The real problem here is that, you know, some people think that they're entitled to be protected against against verbal assaults, and nobody else. Mm-hmm.
So I'm very much in agreement, and I'm glad you pointed out that the scope and scale of you know, where we extend this freedom of association to, you know, to cover people's you know, desire to retreat is absolutely something that has limits, right? And I don't think it's actually as common as you might think that as people might think that the ask here is for a university-wide haven from all ideas that one might disagree with. Could I interject about one point? I just wanted to go back to something you said. I know we're running out of time. You said, how do we best optimize these different needs, these different principles? And then I'm just started to think about my personal experiences. And do we really need to optimize two different principles? Or is one principle just so much better than another? Because, and I'll draw from my personal experience here, like, you know, coming out as gay to conservative has never been an issue in my life. But coming out as conservative to gays has caused a lot of problems. And I have been macro-aggressed against. I have been shouted at in public places by other gays. And I'm thinking, sitting to myself, thinking here, would I ever try to optimize, you know, my safe space and my ability not to hear that with their ability to make some sort of speech? No. There's no question. I would never sacrifice their right to speak as aggressively, as hatefully as they want, with my right to be comfortable. So I just don't think there's anything to be optimized here.
Should be perfect. All right, thanks.
Sweet, last word. I have no logo.